Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Today, we navigate the puzzling question of bird migration.
Essentially, they're extrapolating from what they know and predicting that the field will change in the same way. It is a remarkable thing.
We hear how AI can unravel the language of biology and ponder the probability of existence itself.
If there is a multiverse of universes, then we would be in a rather unusual one.
A big international conference will be seeking ways to protect the world's environment this month. No, I'm not talking COP29 in Baku, negotiating climate change. That's getting plenty of coverage elsewhere on the World Service. This is plastics and a United Nations commitment to binding rules to limit plastic pollution to be agreed in Korea by the start of December. It's a mammoth challenge, given how cheap and convenient plastics are, especially for single-use packaging. But an analysis by experts in science this week says that with the right political will and with some substantial, though affordable, investment, the current swelling tide of waste can be reversed. And that's impressive, given we're already making over 500 million tonnes of the stuff each year, which the authors project will grow to 750 million tonnes by 2050 if we do nothing. The worrying element is the 60 million tonnes of it that are neither recycled nor disposed of safely, the stuff that pollutes the environment, set to double, they expect, by 2050. But, as I say, the experts, represented here by marine ecologist Neil Nathan, are confident we can do much better.
Our research has actually tried to bring science and data to the table and sort of arm the negotiators and the delegates of this treaty with the latest science, with the latest data to best understand what are we on track for, what are we looking at in terms of plastic waste through 2040, through 2050, and then also what is the potential impact that this treaty might actually have. Right now, you have a lot of developed countries that tend to be larger consumers of plastic as well as producers, but then you have developing regions where either this plastic waste is being shipped overseas due to less regulations governing waste requirements, and then you also have, you know, plastic washing up on the beaches of, for example, small island developing states as it goes from rivers, from oceans to other communities. Really, there are a variety of pathways that we can get to address this problem. And that's the real beauty behind a treaty like this, is that, of course, at the downstream area where we can consider in channeling new money and investments into waste management infrastructure, improving things like landfills and incinerators, improving recycling infrastructure, particularly in regions that are receiving the largest burden of plastic waste. We can also consider different policies that actually change some of the upstream demand of plastic.
So from what I see in your paper, you're saying that currently we produce about 400 million tons of plastic waste every year. Most of that goes to landfill, is that right? About a fifth of it is recycled, about a quarter is burned, and then the rest is the stuff that I guess is most concerning, is that's the stuff which just blows into the environment. In a sense, you're trying to squeeze down on all of those with these policies, is that right?
Exactly. And some of these downstream policies are, of course, going to change the fractions, you know, increase the amount of that ultimate plastic waste that goes into landfills, that goes into incinerators, and that goes into recycling, therefore reducing mismanaged waste. But at the end of the day, it is still waste. Landfills and incinerators, some of them are pretty responsibly managed. Others are open dumps or open burning. That actually in our model is considered mismanaged waste as well, because it is essentially pollution to the environment. But if we focus on downstream policies, yeah, we can reduce the fraction of that mismanaged waste that is pollution, putting more into responsibly managed landfills, incinerators. But if we begin to also look at the upstream policies, and that's sort of beginning to think about reducing production, defining sustainable levels of production from now into the future, that's the only real way that we can see how to actually eliminate this problem. One of the large goals is how do we eliminate plastic pollution by 2040, by 2050? And that sounded like an incredible challenge that we weren't even sure at the beginning of this research if that was even possible. But the amazing finding is that our research and our model that sort of takes in all of this consumption data, takes in changes in GDP and population growth across different world regions, we realized that we can actually decrease the mismanaged waste by more than 91% with just 4 policies on the table.
That's interesting. So break down those policies. The upstream one, so that's what you make. What, we have to limit how much we make, or is it a question of having more recycled plastic?
Exactly. So upstream policies would actually be putting some sort of production limits on the plastic itself. So for example, you could just come up with a specific level, such as the amount of plastic that we were producing in 2020, and create that as the limit, and then create a policy, a mandate that prevents any more plastic than those levels being produced. That is, of course, going to be a really impactful policy. And we find that it has significant reductions alone on the outlook of mismanaged waste entering the environment in 2050. However, it is, of course, pretty contentious. And it's one of the more controversial issues that's on the table with the treaty, particularly as some countries really want ambition and really want plastic production to be decreased. Others would really prefer for the treaty to focus on these downstream measures. The other most impactful policy that our research shows is this post-consumer recycled content. So if you require that new products be made with 40%, for example, post-consumer recycled content, that actually has a huge reduction, maybe around 40% or more, on the mismanaged waste that we're seeing enter the environment in 2050. And the reason that this has such a big impact is because you are actually driving new demand for the recycled material, and you're thereby reducing the demand for virgin plastic polymer.
One of the policies you have is putting a $50 billion investment into handling the waste after it's been produced. Are you thinking here of the rich nations actually investing in the infrastructure needed elsewhere in the world, so in Africa and in India and so on?
Exactly. So the treaty really presents an opportunity to mobilize those funds from wealthier nations to lower income nations, and thereby help with that issue, particularly because the most mismanaged waste that we are seeing is in these developing regions. There are a ton of different innovative financing mechanisms that are also being considered in the treaty that certainly could mobilize that level of investment across the world. Some of the things that have been discussed are an international fee on virgin plastic polymer, for example, $60 to $90 per ton of virgin polymer, and place that responsibility on the producer itself. That alone would be able to generate enough funding to essentially fund an entirely comprehensive global plastics treaty. And we also find that, you know, if the producer even passed that entire cost onto the consumer, it would really only increase the price of a plastic-based good by around less than 1%. So really, some of these things might feel negligible in terms of changes in price, but can actually mobilize enough money to really fund a lot of these comprehensive policies.
Neil Nathan of the Marine Science Institute in Santa Barbara, California. And by the way, if plastics were a country, it would be responsible for more carbon dioxide emissions than any other, apart from China, the US and India. The policies Neil was talking about would slash those two, which is what I call a win-win. We didn't talk about it, but that analysis used machine learning to project past trends in plastic use and waste forwards to 2050. It's more and more a theme in our reporting here on Science in Action. AI to give better weather forecasts, to identify vast numbers of worrying unknown viruses, and of course, as just recognised with the Nobel Prize, to convert gene sequences into protein structures. Proteins are essentially the working components of a living cell, but the machinery of that cell requires large numbers of components and all to work together. A study this week, also in Science for what it's worth, reports on an AI approach that goes one level up from that Nobel Prize-winning AlphaFold, synthesizing all the genetic and protein information from over 2.5 million bacteria and viruses to get a systems-level computer view of life. It's called Evo and has been keeping Patrick Sue busy for many years.
The key idea that we had was that the genome contains the DNA, the RNA, and the proteins, and apparently everything else that's required to make an entire functional organism, right? And so could we train a machine learning model that learns across whole genomes at scale in order to try to learn something about the instructions that create life, right? And could we decode this foreign language of biology, right, using such a model? And so that's sort of why we called the model Evo, because we were trying to learn the language of evolution you can try to ask the model questions, right? And generally, these types of large language models can be used for two different classes of tasks, prediction tasks and design tasks, right? And so what we showed is that Evo is able to be a multimodal model. So across the different modes of the central dogma of molecular biology, DNA and RNA and proteins, it's able to predict, you know, what's going to happen, you know, kind of generally across all of these different modes. But it's also able to do design. So we're able to design individual molecules, how these molecules interact with each other, such as, you know, proteins that bind to RNAs, and then also even sequences potentially at the scale of whole genomes. And so we actually use the model to generate genome-like sequences over a million bases in length, which is actually larger than many, many genomes.
And I suppose what I'm not quite clear is how this Evo machine integrates this information. I suppose what it seems to me that it's so much bigger than AlphaFold, and yet I'm sort of still struggling to sort of really understand how AlphaFold works.
Yeah, so AlphaFold focuses on proteins, and it's trying to do protein structure prediction, right? And you can train, you know, protein language models to, do this specific task called next word or next token prediction, right? And so this is sort of the key insight between things like ChatGPT, where you try to predict the next word to be or not to be, right? We all know what the next word is. But if I gave you a DNA sequence, GTG, CATC, right, what would the next base be? But it actually turns out, just like in natural language, right, just in the way that this very seemingly deceptively simple task of predicting the next word can teach you general things like grammar, world knowledge, or even spatial navigation, right? You can similarly learn very general things about biology, right? At the task of, you know, for example, in molecular biochemistry, if you wanted to predict the next residue, if it's hydrophobic or hydrophilic, it can tell you something about the kind of the charge of a protein binding pocket, right? Or if you want to predict the next nucleotide, it might be able to predict the difference between a healthy nucleotide and one that causes a rare genetic disease like sickle cell anemia, right? And so just sort of at massive scale, you're learning something about the functional adaptations, right, that are passed down throughout generations of life.
So in a sense, you're getting this grammar. You're looking at the relationship between the genes and then the proteins that they make and so on. And you're able to construct a grammar, which I suppose says these genes or these kinds of genes are ones you would expect to work together because that's what happens in real life.
Exactly, exactly. And so genomes embed, kind of multiple different elements inside of them. And so with what's called a long context type of model, the model is able to learn across all these different interactions between these different elements, which are embedded fundamentally within DNA. So in the field, folks have previously trained task-specific models only on proteins or only on codons or only on RNA. And instead, we think of Evo as the first foundational model for biology because it learns everything, you know, at DNA alone, which embeds all of that information.
So if I can take an example, I don't think this one's in your paper, but my muscles operate because they've got a whole host of different proteins. Some of them are sort of mechanical ones. They're the ones that make the movement. Other ones are there to provide the energy that allows the movement. Others sort of receive the nervous signal. So to have a working muscle, you need to have a whole host of genes to do it. Is it those kinds of associations that that Evo can work with?
Yeah, so this model is learning about, you know, DNA, right?
Yeah.
And so it learns so at massive scale. And so in a way, you know, this is a statistical mirror to function, right? Because, you know, the sort of functional adaptations and of natural selection are reflected within DNA mutations. And the model is able to learn across all of that to learn something about cellular function or potentially even whole organism fitness, right? But the model doesn't itself, at least in this version, natively understand something like RNA, right? And we're interested in training kind of future versions of these that can also learn something about things like cell state if you believe RNA can be a representation of how cells are responding to the environment, right? So you learn in high school that it's sort of, you know, genes and the environment that collaborate to create phenotype. And so, you know, kind of moving forward, right, we'll certainly make larger and larger scale versions of these EVO models, you know, not just on single cellular life, but also on multicellular life. But we're also interested in integrating information for other biological sequences like RNA and proteins in order to create these kind of, you know, large language models of life. And we think this can be a new paradigm for creating bioengineering tools.
Patrick Su of the ARC Institute in California, and I've a feeling we're going to hear quite a lot about uses of EVO or similar systems in biology over the coming years. Just another reason to keep listening to Science in Action from the BBC World Service every week. It may seem computer models are taking over in biology, but there is still plenty to be done with a well-designed experiment. I say that thinking of the patient, watchful work trying to understand how migrating birds manage to accurately navigate across thousands of kilometres. I get that their internal compass might tell them which way is north or south, but a direction is only helpful if you know where you're starting from relative to your destination. Something of a mental map, which clever experiments have just shown, birds can work out from subtle variations in the magnetic field across the face of the Earth. Remember, you can only test this when the birds get the itch to move as the days get shorter and colder in this part of the world. As I say, patience as well as cleverness is needed. Ecologist Richard Holland has both.
What we're looking at is how these birds are able to recognize that they're not where they should be and actually correct their direction that they fly to head back to the place they're trying to get to, which for these migratory birds is their wintering grounds, in this case in Africa. So these small migratory birds, the reed warbler, the Eurasian reed warbler.
And you're doing these experiments in Austria, so that's sort of, basically they would expect to be heading due south, which
their magnetic compass would tell you. Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, you sort of manipulated the magnetic field in a laboratory to make them think they're somewhere in the Urals.
That's right, yeah. So we did what is actually quite a remarkable thing in some respects. There's been a lot of experiments that have tested birds' navigation ability by packing them up into a box and transporting them to a different place and releasing them and seeing that they can correct. So we know already that we know famously that homing pigeons can do this, but also many migratory birds, there's been displacement experiments showing that if you take them to a place they've never been to before, that they can recognize they're in the wrong place and correct their course to head back where they should. Although only birds that have already made one migratory journey, not juveniles. So the juveniles are birds that are born that year, making their first migration. They don't appear to have any knowledge of their final destination. They've never been there before, and there seems to be no sort of innate or genetically encoded knowledge of that. But for adult birds, this seems to be possible. But what we've done is actually not move the birds at all, but instead move the Earth's magnetic field, because the Earth's magnetic field changes depending on where you are on its surface. There's different components of it. So its total strength, its inclination, which is the angle that magnetic field lines form with the Earth's surface. And then another thing called declination. And declination is a consequence of the fact that the magnetic pole is not exactly under the top of the Earth. So if you can measure the geographical North Pole and the magnetic North Pole, depending on where you are, they change in relation by an angle. So these components change across the Earth's surface. And so you can actually, sometimes you can change the magnetic field to look like a different place. And so that's what we did. We didn't just change the direction. That was a little part of it, but we changed all of the magnetic signatures initially to look like a different place on the Earth's surface.
And so the inclination is the fact that if you're at the North Pole, it's coming up straight through your feet, whereas
if you're
at the equator, it's sort of parallel to your head.
Parallel to your head, yeah. So the best way to visualize this is you can Google it. If you get a bar magnet and sprinkle iron filings, you'll see those magnetic field lines coming up, out, and around, and back in again, yeah.
So in the lab, you're able just to fool the poor birds?
Yeah, so we have this device called a Helmholtz coil, which is actually very simple. It's just a series of wires, and you run electricity through it, and magnetism and electricity are linked, so you can change the magnetic field inside the Helmholtz coil. So our coil is about 2 meter by 2 meter by 2 meter cube. And then the birds, we actually test them inside the coil. So we never release the birds. Interestingly, small migratory birds show a behavior called migratory restlessness. So they hop around and get very active at night, even though they're diurnal birds during their breeding season, because they migrate at night. So they get very restless and hop around. And back in the 60s, someone put them in a funnel-shaped cage and discovered that they try and escape from that cage in the direction that they would be migrating in the wild. So we have this fantastic measure of their desire of which direction to migrate without them really moving. So we can keep them inside.
It's sort of like they're on the edge of this funnel, sort of try to find a way out in the right direction.
Exactly, yeah. And they say, I need to migrate and I'll start this direction, yeah.
And so the short version then of your result is that if they were in the natural magnetic field of Austria, they headed in the right direction. But when you put them in where they might imagine was somewhere in Russia, they still headed in the correct direction. They made that correction.
They made a correction. So they changed from southeast to southwest, because this place that we took them to was about 2,500 kilometers away to their east. So they switched massively.
I mean, were they confused?
Well, that's what's interesting. They appeared not to be. They responded in a way that's consistent with them thinking, oh, I've been displaced and I need to correct. Even though everything else in that orientation, they had access to the stars, they had access to any odors, they could see a little bit.
They could see the stars.
Everything else told them that they were in Austria, where they'd been captured and where they'd been in a cage just a few days before while we prepared the experiment. But then just by only changing this magnetic field, and interestingly, in our current paper, we only changed two of those components, the inclination and declination. And they responded as if they were somewhere else and needed to correct.
I think what's so interesting is you said that these were mature birds, so they had migrated before, and so in a sense they had got a feeling, shall we say, for their magnetic environment on that migration. That was their way of sort of calibrating their internal system.
So what we think they do is, as they move through from their breeding grounds to their wintering grounds and back again, we think they notice how the magnetic field changes in these different parameters. That inclination as they go south decreases. I think they winter around the equator, so that's a zero inclination. And as they go back north, that increases. Declination in Western Europe, declination sort of changes approximately with latitude, so that's quite nice. They learn, okay, inclination increases as I go north, declination changes as I go west or east. And then it's not that they know the magnetic parameters in the place we take them to, but they've learned inclination is much higher than I've ever experienced it, so I must be further north than I've ever been. Declination has changed in this way towards the east, and therefore I must be further east than I've ever been. So it's essentially they're extrapolating from what they know and predicting that the field will change in the same way. It is a remarkable thing.
Richard Holland of Bangor University, whose latest insights were just shared in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. The ultimate question is that of existence itself. Not 42, as in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, but perhaps something like 500. Let me explain. There are lots of arguments that life exists only because of the unusual physical properties of water, or because of the remarkable chemistry of carbon, which allows for gazillion complex interacting biomolecules. More cosmically, it's been argued, you need nuclear fusion in the stars to turn the hydrogen of the Big Bang into carbon and to other elements, and to give the heat and light that fuel life. That, in turn, depends on the tuning of the nuclear forces. There's another barrier, but at a bigger scale still, what I hadn't expected was that dark energy, the mysterious stuff spread out super thinly over all of space, discovered only 25 years ago, might itself be the ultimate go-no-go of existence. In other words, the philosophical argument goes, any universe with the wrong dark energy would have no astronomers making the measurements to see that those numbers are wrong. But cosmologist Daniele Serini has run the calculations and says that dark energy is actually a factor 500 out from the ideal value. Yep, here we are. It's all to do, he says, with the best value that leads to galaxies and stars in them, that lead to carbon, light, water, and so on.
Because dark energy accelerates the expansion of the universe, if there is too much of it, then it would make the universe expand so fast that it would eventually become impossible for gravity to form galaxies and then subsequently stars, planets, and ultimately life. So that's the connection between the abundance of dark energy and us being here.
So at one end, if the universe is expanding too fast, basically it's just always a blur and nothing terribly interesting happens. There's no stars, no galaxies. At the other end, if there's no dark energy?
Well, if there is no dark energy, you would still have expansion and you would have more galaxies, more structures. However, and this is an interesting result of our paper that actually surprised me when I found it, even in that case, we find you could have fewer stars overall, because one thing is how many galaxies you can form. Quite another is how efficient each galaxy is at forming stars. So we find that on one end, if you have no dark energy, you would have more galaxies, but they would be overall less efficient at forming stars. And on the other end, if you've got a lot of dark energy, then you would have efficient galaxies, but there would be very few of those. So that was an interesting point.
So each, in that spirit, that each galaxy is, as we said, see them, an island of stars, you want to have that sort of best match of the number of stars inside a galaxy plus the number of galaxies in the universe. And the more, when you get the maximum number there, that's sort of when you're most likely to find planets orbiting those stars and smart people talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea. There are these two competing effects, and it tells us how many galaxies we've got in total that can tell you how easy it would be for an intelligent life form at some point to emerge somewhere in the universe.
So the anthropic principle, so this is the idea that we're here to see the universe, is because the kind of universe that produces us is the most likely to happen. Is the value of dark energy that you sort of plug into your equations the actual one that the astronomers measure? In other words, you know, is the universe perfect for us?
Well, actually, we vary the value of dark energy between zero and 100,000 times the one that we observe in our universe. So we are considering many different possibilities. And according to our model, we find that our universe is not the most fine-tuned to promote the emergence of life in the universe. And the interesting thing is, in fact, even if the abundance of dark energy were larger than the one we observe, we would still be able to form intelligent observers, it seems.
I suppose I'm trying to get to grips with the implications of the numbers, the equations that you've done, because it sounds like we're not in the best universe, but evidently we are here talking about it. I mean, does this mean there might be other universes in a multiverse where people have been asking this lots more intelligent beings, and possibly a lot quicker off the mark human beings?
That's a good way to put it. If there is a multiverse of universes, then we would be in a rather unusual one. And if you picked a random observer in this multiverse of possibilities, of possible universes, and asked them what value of dark energy they measure, most of them will give you a number larger than the one that we do measure here.
I mean, how do you move on from here? In a funny way, what I'd really like would be all the observers in these other universes, if they exist, to be putting the number, the value of their lander, of their dark energy, in a bottle and throwing it into a wormhole that might end up in our universe, and then you could collect all those bottles and see what everyone else's value is. I'm not quite sure how you don't know what any other universe might be like, even if it exists. You're in a bit of a conundrum, aren't you?
Yeah, well, we cannot measure other universes if they exist. So this is more of a thought experiment to better understand the foundations of our own cosmological model. It's not uncommon to do these sort of exercises in physics. We say, what if it were that different? What would that imply for our models, for our understanding of the universe? And so that's sort of the idea behind it. So we're not saying that anthropic arguments are necessarily wrong. We're just putting a caveat on how we apply it. We're saying it's not necessarily so simple to say, oh, we are here observing, we observe this value of dark energy just because otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
Which would be very sad. No one to listen in to Science in Action. No BBC World Service to broadcast it. No Alex Mansfield to produce it. No Daniele Serini to run those calculations. No University of Durham to provide the computer. No Royal Astronomical Society to publish the results. No Roland Pease to stretch this joke out longer than it deserves.